keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business. This is Voice America Business.
Welcome to Design Matters with Debbie Millman, the show that takes you inside the provocative and stimulating world of design and branding as it intersects with contemporary culture. Here's your host of Design Matters, Debbie Millman.
Lately, I've been thinking a lot about space. Not space as in Star Trek space, but space as in the space around us. Space as in the invisible boundaries we've designed around ourselves to create a sense of privacy, of protection, of, well, space to create a sense of self. I had three experiences in a row provoking this inner dialogue. The first occurred while riding an elevator up to the 17th floor of my office, which is in the Empire State Building. It is a huge, bustling monolith with people dashing out and about and hordes of tourists snapping pictures. On this particular day, I was happily able to snag an elevator to myself and was avidly distracted by the strangely hypnotic television screens broadcasting the latest news, time, and temperature. The car stopped at the 7th floor and a man got on. Ordinarily, when getting on an elevator, a very silent but pervasive series of mannerisms, quirks, and behaviors set forth. Mostly, people tend to retreat to a corner of their own and will often move several feet from where they are to allow for a comfortable spatial distance to form around themselves. This seems to be done almost automatically. However, this particular gentleman did not retreat to a corner. He stood directly behind me. He wasn't close enough to actually touch me. He wasn't being offensive in any way. He was just spatially too close, given how much room was in the rest of the elevator. When I got off on the 17th floor, I felt oddly perturbed. My second experience occurred as I was walking home from work. There were lots of people coming and going, racing home for dinner, American Idol, and that wonderful first glass of wine. Then, out of nowhere, a woman caught up to my pace and started walking parallel with me. Not ahead of me by a few steps, not behind me by a foot or two, but right next to me, as if we were companions, walking side by side. She didn't seem to be trying to pass me, as is often the case when I'm walking wearing high heels. She just matched my step. Again, I felt odd, and then relieved when I turned the corner and she didn't. According to a paper written by psychologists Allen and Bacon, environmental psychology is the study of how physical settings affect human behavior. It also studies how people govern their environment. Environmental psychologists often act as consultants to governments, schools, hospitals, churches, and museums. They might provide museum layouts to create more dynamic displays. But in many cases, these psychologists study environmental variables, like crowding and spatial density, and how people can become apathetic or even hostile when they feel uncomfortable or encroached. Another noted psychologist, G. Stanley Hall, suggested that personal space is a mechanism by which people communicate with others, similar to verbal communication, body language, and written or designed communication. He proposed that people first adhere to norms of personal space in childhood. But this is also a very Western concept, wherein large personal space is insisted on, with proximity reserved for close friends. In some Arab and Eastern cultures, for example, there is a much smaller distance between strangers that is acceptable. To explain personal space in the U.S., Hall classified four spatial zones, and they are as follows. An intimate distance of 0 to 18 inches is maintained between people who are highly familiar with one another. A personal distance of 1.5 to 4 feet is acceptable between friends and acquaintances. Social distance, 4 to 12 feet, is used for business and interaction with strangers, and public distance of 12 to 25 feet or more minimizes personal contact. All of these zones seem rather logical. In fact, I find they allow for an easy explanation of why we might want to step away from someone we don't know in a closed elevator. But my third and final experience, what would ordinarily be considered a fairly common phenomenon, proved rather remarkable in the face of these findings. Traveling downtown during rush hour to meet a friend for dinner, I found myself crushed into a pile of people without even a handrail to hang on to. Whenever the train stopped, I fell forward or sideways, tumbling deeper into the strangers surrounding me. I wasn't traveling with any of them per se, and yet I knew the woman next to me smelled like she was wearing Obsession by Calvin Klein, and the teenager to my left was listening to This Is Why I'm Hot on her iPod, and the man on my right was reading Prozac Nation, and the man next to him had circles of sweat under his arms, and the woman across from us had chipped fingernail polish, a button missing on the sleeve of her blouse, and was carrying what was likely her dinner in a white paper bag from Quiznos. Suddenly I realized, for whatever reason, it was perfectly acceptable to lose all conventional mannerisms of spatial zoning in an effort to allow one more person to stuff themselves, mosh style, into a subway car in order to ensure that they, too, could get to dinner on time. Quite naturally, and without giving it a second thought, all of this was done without the slightest hint of verbal communication or a fleeting glance in someone else's eyes. The irony of the earlier anxiety I felt during the ride with the man in the elevator or walking with the woman on the street was not lost on me. Space, in this case, was extremely relative and mutually nullified. And yet, amidst all of our quirky physical machinations to maintain spatial autonomy, we still seek to understand where we belong and how we fit in or not. When we design, we attempt to analyze the space between letters, tension between colors, patterns in the grid, negative space on the page, how elements best work together or don't. The rest of the time we orbit and navigate around the people and things we want to get close to, those we want to step away from, those we try not to notice, those we try to get to notice us, what our boundaries are, and why. Welcome to Design Matters with Debbie Millman. I am your host, Debbie Millman, and my guest today is Stephen Heller, who's sitting about 4 feet away from me. Before we get started with today's interview, please let me tell you a bit more about him. Stephen Heller is the co-chair of the MFA Designer as Author program at the School of Visual Arts and the co-founder of the MFA in Design Criticism. He has been a senior art director at the New York Times and currently writes the new quarterly visuals column in the New York Times Book Review, as well as obituaries on designers and illustrators. He is the editor of AIGA's Voice, online journal of design, and the author, editor, or co-author of over 100 books on design and visual culture, most recently Stylepedia, a guide to graphic design mannerisms, quirks, and conceits with Louise Feely, and Anatomy of Design, a guide to graphic design mannerisms, and the Anatomy of Design with Mirko Ilic, and Shop America with Jim Hyman. He is currently working on Iron Fist, Branding the Totalitarian State for Faden Books, and a biography of Alvin Lustig with Elaine Lustig, Cohen for Chronicle. In October, the School of Visual Arts will devote a retrospective exhibition to his art direction and authorship. Welcome, Steve.
Hi. Am I enough space?
Four feet? Yeah. Nearly intimate. Mm-hmm. Nearly intimate physical space. So I am in love with one of your latest books, Stylepedia, a guide to graphic design mannerisms, quirks, and conceits. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. And so the first question I wanted to ask you is how you would describe this book, first of all, and second, what made you decide to write it?
To pick up girls.
Well, it worked for Louise. You'd have been successful.
There you go.
So tell me, how did you decide to, what made you decide to write the book, first of all? And what made you decide to write it? How would you describe it? And also, how did you come up with the title? Lots of questions. First, right off the bat.
Lots of questions. Well, I do a number of books every year, so in one sense, the decision was made, what is the book I'm going to do this month? I wanted to do a book that addressed one of my favorite obsessions, and that is style.
Mm-hmm.
Style for good, style for bad. But what is style? I have a very broad definition of what is style. And I've written with Seymour Quast a book called Graphic Style. Louise and I have done books on deco style. And I wanted to somehow gather material together and show the diversity of style, that it's not just about the things we know, Art Deco, Art Nouveau, but that it's about things like psychedelia. It's things like pornographic little magazines. Anything that has more than one particular thing that then the attributes extend on into other areas. So style is a personality. And what I'm trying to get at is there are 150 different kinds of design that have unique personalities.
Now, you and your co-author, Louise Feely, I read this, that you scoured the rural roots of the graphic design landscape to come up with 113 interesting entries for the book, from agate, retro, to Xanol. And you acknowledge that the choices for what to include in were your own choices, for what you consider to be worthwhile graphic styles from the last 100 years or so, and they include modernist and deconstruction, distill, Dada, and so forth. But one of my favorites, by the way, is Teen Magazine. But I do have some questions for you regarding some of the choices. And so two of the questions that I have were, what was it about Chinese calendar girls that compelled you to include that, and then also about the mini mannequin?
Well, I'll start with the mini mannequin. I did a book, actually Louise and I did this book, called Counterculture.
Yes.
And it was a tiny little paper over boards book that was a collection of mini mannequins. All of a sudden I started buying these things. I mean, a lot of the stuff I do is because I'm just fascinated with
them. Now, aren't mini mannequins like Barbie dolls?
No.
I mean, how big are mini mannequins?
Mini mannequins.
What is a mini mannequin?
Mini mannequins are big mannequins reduced to about 24 inches or less in height, and they're countertop displays.
Oh, I see.
And you used to find them, if you were alive in the 40s or 30s, you'd find them in shops and haberdashers or drug stores or even hardware stores, and they would be on the counter and they would be dressed in the attire, either real clothes that were made doll-like or they would be painted on. And particularly in drug stores, you'd find women and men wearing trusses and all sorts of girdles and bandages and things like that. And they're really quite amazing when you look at them. I call them sculptures of commerce.
Oh,
and
beautiful.
So I looked at it in relation to everything I was doing at that particular moment. I mean, I was interested in Art Deco, and these come out of the Art Deco period, although they're not specifically Deco. I've always been interested in commercial culture and the artifacts that represent commercial culture. So that's what these things are. They were the first line of defense, of offense, whatever you want to call it, in that consumerist war. They were on the counter. You look at these things, you get a sense of sensibility from them. If it's in a men's shop, you see the man wearing the hat or the jacket or the shoes. And they come in all different shapes. They come in all different personalities. And they're based on larger mannequins, which are also based on human beings. I mean,
right.
Every mannequin has a name, and it's usually a human name, and it's sometimes a movie star's name. So all of these things had that, but these were more pristine, and they were miniaturized, and everybody loves miniature anything,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And
sure.
I have hundreds of these in an apartment that I rented, and they stand there. Now they stand there along with Chinese cultural revolutionary figurines. So they're
constantly
boring.
Wow, so you've got like a whole family going on in there.
There's a family feud, and Louise refuses to go into this apartment, but I stayed there one night, and believe me, when I turned off the lights, they came alive.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's very creepy.
Now, where is this apartment?
I can't give the address or people will want to come.
Okay. Well, Steve, we have to take our first break. There's so much I want to talk to you about today. My office here is covered with your books and all sorts of examples of your writing and things that I want to talk about. But in the meantime, I have to let everybody know that they're listening to Design Matters with Debbie Millman on Voice America Business. I am your host, Debbie Millman, and my guest today is writer, editor, art director, and educator, Stephen Heller. We'll be right back with our broadcast after these messages, so please don't go away.
...401s, stock, mortgage, retirement, wealth. We cover it all. Voice America Business.
Welcome to Voices of Design, brought to you by Adobe, where creative professionals speak out about their work and what inspires them. We're speaking with Paul Sidlow, the CEO and founder of Resonate, a design agency that develops the media identity for clients across a broad range of platforms. Paul, tell us how you begin the process of creating a brand for a client.
We create a language that bears the brand of that company. To do that, we will take keywords of a brand attribute, smart, illuminating, and make that into an icon. And so our job is to provide, quickly define that language. And it's a little bit like sculpting. You got a block, and somewhere in there is that person. And you carve that person out through this process. And the faster you can get to that, the more efficient you are, and the more time you save that customer in getting to market.
You've been listening to Voices of Design, brought to you by Adobe. Coming up in the next break, Paul Sidlow talks about creating imaginary worlds.
It has been said that to live is to choose, but to choose well, you must know who you are and what you stand for, where you want to go, and why you want to get there. On Reap What You Sow, with host, performance management specialist, and executive coach, Alana Daly, achievement and success through expanding yourself and your life is available at the click of a mouse. Reap through redefining your goals. Educate your mind, your body, your conscious, and unconscious. Apply what you learn and plan, and it shall be success over and over again, and wealth result when you reap regularly. Reap What You Sow with Alana Daly, broadcast each Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Reap What You Sow. Learn the rules of the game, then play better than anyone else.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business, this is Voice America Business.
We're back with Design Matters with Debbie Millman. If you have a question for Debbie, feel free to call us at 866-472-5790. Once again, here's the host of Design Matters, Debbie Millman.
Welcome back. It is 3:20 Eastern Time, and you are listening to Design Matters with Debbie Millman on Voice America Business. I am your host, Debbie Millman, and my guest today is writer, editor, art director, and educator, Stephen Heller. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question for Steve, our phone lines are now open. You can call 1-866-472-5790. And Steve, we have a caller. We have Gregory on the line. Gregory, thank you for calling Design Matters. It's been a couple of weeks since we've heard from you.
It has. Hi, Debbie. Hey, Steve.
Hi.
I have a couple of questions, actually. I'm not a graphic designer, but I have seen your book, Stylepedia, and it's just an amazing, amazing book. I mean, everything about it's amazing. The content's amazing. The look of it's amazing. And the first thing I want to know is whose idea was the thumb index?
Well, I'd like to take total credit for it. My editor, Alan Rapp at Chronicle Books, and I, when we talked about the book, we wanted to make it something of a dictionary and or a Bible or whatever you want to call it. But I think we both agreed at the same time, without any separation of any moment at all, that there should be thumb tabs.
And did you and your wife both choose the content, the visual content, the graphics, the things that you have in there?
Well, Louise designed the book, mm-hmm. and of course we talk about the content, but we separate husband and wife, or church and state, or writer and designer. So it's a unit. It's a totality. I mean, I don't believe a designer is not... A designer is an author. So Louise's contribution is invaluable as mine, but mine was the writing and picking the material.
All right, because I want to know who found those FTD storefronts from the 30s that I stared at for 20 minutes.
Oh, those are great, aren't they?
They're amazing.
Yeah, I found
I'm trying to find that flower store. I don't know, where can I go?
Well, they used to have them all over New York.
I mean, I know.
That's what I loved about them. They were these... But if the book I did called Shop America, which is a Taschen book with Jim Hyman, there are some beautiful storefronts in there, much more detailed and really gorgeous. And it's those kinds of artifacts that I just, I like you, could just stare at them forever. And then after the staring is over, I've got to find out where they came from and who did them.
Exactly. I collect Christmas cards beginning from the 30s on through the early 70s. And it's curious because I think that's a really prolific body of graphic art that you don't see it today. You sort of don't see detail or thought or texture or, you know, printing processes that way again. And do you have any theory as to why that is? You know, why, you know, greeting cards, which is such a huge business, especially holiday cards, has lost that that look and that style and that diversity?
Well, I don't have a theory about that. I did, the very first book I ever did was called Artist Christmas Cards. And it was actually pretty successful at the time, and I got a lot of artists, including many that were deceased. I went into their collections and found that almost everybody did some sort of greeting card for Christmas, specifically. But in answer to your question, I think, you know, there are some cards that are quite wonderful now. I mean, I still go into stores and I buy cards, and
so do I.
They're funnier. They're not as, you know, there's a cliche of the embossed card and the one with the flowers and the die cuts, and they've just become kind of common and uninteresting. You look at the old patina, and I think we may be seduced by the patina, because I have a lot of Christmas cards, deco cards from the 20s and 30s, and they're okay. They're fine. They're nice. They fit into the stylistic mode, but I don't think the craft of them is any better or worse than they are today.
The last question I have is, is there anything in graphic design today that you find is missing, an element, a really important element that's missing?
Well, that's like a three-hour special with Steve.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I think everything's there. I love everything and everyone.
Well, I'm going to be going out and buying your the rest of the books now. So.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks for calling, Gregory. It's nice to hear your voice again.
Thanks.
So, Steve, let's talk about your other book that is also out concurrently, The Anatomy of Design, which is a book that you did with Mirko Ilić. And these are both what I would call whale of a books. That was a quote that I saw, I think it was on Amazon, about Anatomy of Design. And they really are books that are so dense with such extraordinary information.
Full of blubber.
No, that's not why they're whale of books. They're heavy. They have plunk value. Talk a little bit about Anatomy of Design. It's a very unusual book. It's a book with, about 100 and something?
Well, there are 50 major pieces.
50 major pieces.
And then about 2,000 supplementary pieces. But that's not a way of describing
it. No, it's not. Because the supplementary pieces are essentially a visual journey that leads you all the way either to or all the way back from the earliest influences of that particular piece. So, for example, if we looked at Solar Twins' album Rock the Casbah, we can see the influences going all the way back to a piece from 1894 called The Inland Printer, over to 1984, the Alan Parsons Project, to something from Wired, to something from something that Michael Bierut at Pentagram did. So it's an extraordinary journey of influence, of inspiration, what some people might consider to be outright theft or plagiarism. Talk about how you constructed this idea for the book.
Well, it's about language. The whole book is about language, although we use a lot, we mix a lot of metaphors here. The way this started is, I love working with other people in various ways, whether they're working to design a book that I write, or whether we're working to conceive a book that I may have had a germ of an idea for. And in this case, this book comes out of a book that Mirko and I did called Genius Moves. Genius Moves was taking one piece of design for each year of the 20th century. That was the conceit. And then we would find some images that came before and images that came after that used the same visual language. And when we did this book, we realized there were many, many more appropriate and similar forms that went along with these things. But we had to limit ourselves because of the format that we decided. Well, when that book went out of print, we decided, well, this is a great opportunity to see how far we could go. So what I wanted to do was something called a side of beef. And a side of beef is, we all know what they are. If you go into a butcher store, you see the cow cut in half, and you see where the thigh is and the liver is and all that stuff, all these tasty products. But it's also a term that we used to use at the New York Times for an information graphic that would take apart pieces of a larger theme or a larger issue, and you'd find them component pieces. So I said to Mirko, let's do a book. We'll call it Anatomy of Design, and we'll split the skeleton in half. And actually, Dorland Kinderle books were influential because they did these IC books, which are quite beautiful.
That would have been interesting to do a journey in Anatomy of Design on how you got to the Anatomy of Design.
Well, actually, Mirko's going to do a talk like that.
Oh, he is?
Because it's very complicated, time-consuming, and almost suicide-causing. We decided to do it where we'd show a number of pieces. It was kind of like the separated at birth thing I do for print magazine, but much more elaborate. And I gave the idea to Mirko, and the next thing I know, he's finding 30, 40, 50 different levels of influence or inspiration. And it all of a sudden got out of hand. But it was brilliant. It was amazing to see these things. So we'd pick a particular piece, and then we'd find, or Mirko really, would find a lot of these different levels.
How did he find them?
On each, he just, you know, he'd go into annuals, he'd go into magazines, he had people looking for stuff, we'd put it in a pile, he'd put it on a wall, we'd come back, we'd look at the things on the wall, then we'd look at these sheets of paper that he'd create with all these basically timelines.
Yeah. Absolutely, it's a visual
timeline.
Except
they're timelines on many different levels.
Yes.
And so once he started doing that, I just thought, I'm going to have to kill myself because I don't know how to address all of this material. But because he designed it with this brilliant idea to do them as gatefolds.
Right.
And once the gatefold idea kicked in, then it made perfect sense. I could write what I needed to write to explain what was going on in terms of the original piece and some of the influences. And then the rest of it, the visuals spoke for themselves. But it really took years to do. We were very late with this book.
Oh, really?
And it was...
I mean, it's not surprising.
It was costly, both in terms of emotion and financial. I mean, you can't do these books on a whim, and to make it valuable, to have something that people can look at and really kind of pore over, that is the goal. I mean, not of all books, certainly not of all eye candy books, but this isn't an eye candy book. So I'm very proud of it.
But in a way it is.
Well, in a way it is, but you're getting more than
eye candy.
It's gratifying, but it's gratifying because you can trace all of these. It's alluring as more than gratifying, I think. There's an allure when you open up these gatefolds, and you see all of this stuff. Some of it is just verbatim copied from what existed now or what existed then, but it doesn't necessarily mean they were stolen. It just means that the ideas were in the air, and we managed through our editorial prerogative to put them all together.
Now, in the introduction to the book, you write that designers are not typically conscious of the sources of their work. And yet, it's very clear when you look at these visual journeys, these visual timelines, that things were happening not only at the same time so that they were in the air, but also could be 100 years before. So what do you think is the difference between influence, borrowing, and outright plagiarism or stealing?
Well, Picasso said that when he takes from somebody else, it's influence. When somebody takes from him, it's stealing. So I think it's a
but they're not everybody in, not everybody in the book would be a Picasso.
No, I mean, the other part of this equation is this is about graphic design. This is not about art in the large A sense. Graphic design is a vernacular form. It's a public form. Like fashion, you expect there to be form givers or originators, but then you are it's logical that if something succeeds, it's going to be repeated.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens throughout any commercial art. So in this case, even the things that were probably stolen fit into this category of it's part of the vernacular and ergo it's part of the language.
Mm-hmm.
So we can use the words the and was and then. Who's stealing from who? It's when we put those words together to form sentences, then we get into intellectual property.
Well, then it's ideas.
And then it's ideas. But a lot of this material in here is not so much ideas, it's about surface, it's about style. And some of them are about ideas, and clearly those ideas may be in the air, or one creator saw an idea over there and said, well, I'm going to incorporate that into what I do. And that's the history of art. Mm-hmm. I mean, the history of art is incorporation and then transcendence.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you heard from any of the designers that are featured in the book and in their analysis of the path to their work? Were they surprised at the amount of influence that they suddenly find themselves a part of?
Well, that's a great question, because the answer is no.
Really?
The answer is no. The only people we approached for the book were the main pieces, and we got permissions from them. Everything else is fair usage.
Mm-hmm.
And for those lawyers in the audience, don't call me. But we are making a statement, and we are making certain assumptions. And I say this in the introduction to the book, that these are not necessarily the intent of any of these designers. I mean, we've asked all the main designers what they were influenced by, but we didn't necessarily go to that particular source verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to make this timeline from what we saw as observers and ergo critics.
Mm-hmm.
But no one has said that's incorrect or that's correct.
Interesting. Very interesting. So after this whole process, do you feel that you can look at anything now and say that it's original?
Well, originality is really such a difficult thing to quantify. But there are original things, and there are original things that have elements of the past and of the present.
Mm-hmm.
So originality is not just something that's never been there before, because we don't recognize it. We're not that smart. It takes a visionary to really see the original. So what we're looking at is a reflection of a lot of different confluences.
You know what I want to ask you about? This is something that I just thought of, and I know that you all already reported on this, and this was the plagiarism of Karen Goldberg's piece for the New York Times Magazine,
The Key,
that she did, and then it showed up in, I think, an automotive brochure.
Right.
And they actually took the entire idea, changed the words, so to speak, the thes and the ands and the was, and appropriated it for their organization. That to me couldn't work in a book like this. I mean, that's what do you think the difference is between something like that, where it is a ripoff, versus something that just looks like something else in a different context?
Well, that is a ripoff. I mean, it's clear that the original idea was unique. It wasn't necessarily totally from whole cloth, insofar as we've seen keys before, and we've mm-hmm. seen those press letters before, those injected letters. But it was a really wonderful idea to launch that particular magazine and to get headlines on the cover. I mean, so many things were perfect about it, so that it carved out its place.
Mm-hmm.
And to see it used in the automotive context, exactly the same, the words are different, that's just pure theft. And, of course, 25 years from now, if we're looking at it, then we have to make another decision. Is it pure theft, or was that such an important piece that it became vernacular, and then this person and two other people used it as well?
Oh, that's interesting. That'll be an interesting thing to look out for. So, Steve, your life is very different now than it was a year ago at this time when we had our last interview, when you were full-time at the New York Times. Now you are doing a lot of writing for the New York Times, but you're also doing about 10 other things. How are you feeling about these new
short
things? How are you feeling about all these new things that you're doing? Or the quantity of things that might not be as new, but are all piled on top of each other as part of your daily life?
You're trying to get me to be Woody Allen and say that all this change just drives me crazy.
That's true.
Yeah.
No, I'm so transparent.
I don't like change, but I do it because we can't sit still. You know, hummingbirds look beautiful when they're humming because they can't stop, and when they stop, they actually look nice and serene for the 2 seconds. And I equate myself with a hummingbird.
I could see that. That,
you know,
that makes sense.
I constantly have to feed myself something. I think, you know, I'm working more at the School of Visual Arts, putting programs together, including this new criticism and design program with which Alice Twemlow will be chairing. I'm still co-chairing the MFA Designer as Author program with my co-founder, Lita Tellerico. And I love working with other people, and I love figuring out new ways of dealing with the kind of content that we as designers deal with.
Mm-hmm. And you seem to be doing even more work for the New York Times now than you were when you were art directing the book review before.
I wouldn't say that.
Well, can you talk a little bit about your Time Select opportunity? Or no? Okay. I got big eyes from Steve.
I'm probably going to be doing a Time Select column on design every other week, starting in June.
Well, let's talk about the Daily Heller. So the Daily Heller is something that you're doing for print magazine, and that is, now, can I actually say that it's a blog?
No.
But it is a blog. Now, this is from a man who said he would never, ever do a blog.
This is not a blog. This is tidbits.
This is tidbits with people's ability to inject commentary.
Well, they can, except for some reason you have to really be a subscriber to this thing in order to inject commentary. And I can honestly say, okay, if it's a blog, mm-hmm. I can take this joy. Nobody has responded.
That's not true.
There are a few people that responded, but they responded because they kind of had to. One of them is a person who I wrote about, and he just wanted to expand on the item. And in fact, two of them are, where they expanded on the item. And the other three, I've counted these things.
Was well, one is Joyce.
My editor, and Joyce, so four. Joyce commented on one, and James Gaddy, who is the my editor there, launched or uploaded three images, and therefore he shows up as a speaker.
Okay. Nevertheless, you do see how many people are looking at the posts.
Yeah, but we don't know what those numbers mean. It's like looking at Amazon numbers. You can't really tell what that means. There's a certain number of, you know, these bots out there.
Mm-hmm.
The robots are great, you know, because they're not people, but they do look at things. Anyway, I have no idea how many people are looking at it, and I don't look at those numbers in a very serious way.
Oh, okay. Well, I was looking, and it seemed like tens of thousands of people were looking at each of the daily entries. What made you decide to do the Daily Heller? That's an awful lot of work.
Well, it was Joyce, Joyce Rutter Kay. She asked me if I'd do it, and I can't say no to Joyce, and I said yes, because that's the opposite of no.
So the Daily Heller is essentially your pick of the day, something interesting, erudite, whimsical, quirky.
It's whatever comes across my desk at 5:30 or 6 o'clock a.m.
Now,
if you look at the times when I post, mm-hmm. it's always before I go to the gym.
Now, oh, that's interesting. Now, you say that comes across your desk. Are people sending you things, or are these things you're actually looking for and find in your searching?
The majority are things that people send, and or that people have sent me with no underlying agenda whatsoever, but strike me as interesting. I mean, there was one post that I made of Myra Kalman's son, mm-hmm. Ibi, who is a filmmaker, and he's just graduating from Bard College, and he and a group of his buddies put together something called the Red Pail, and I just love the website. Myra apparently did the painting of the pail.
Of course.
And I just loved it, so it was worth saying something about and getting other people to look at. So it's those kinds of things, but sometimes people send me stuff as well, and I'll sift through it. I mean, I don't want to run something that ran someplace else.
Well, it seems that between the Daily Heller, the work that you're doing with Heller Books, the work that you're doing with The Times, the work that you're doing with print, you're really turning, the work you're doing with Core 77 and your podcast now, you're really turning into a bit of a media mogul.
Yeah, just call me Turner. And my next wife will be Fonda.
But so you're really branching out to these other forms of media that you hadn't been doing before. How are you enjoying doing the podcasting?
Well, the podcasting is great. I mean, you know, you have to do different things, or it's like, you know, you're supposed to do either crossword puzzles or ballroom dancing to ward off Alzheimer's.
I didn't know that.
You have to do something with the other side of your brain. Well, I think the other side of my brain is long gone, but I still like doing different media. And Lita Tallarico and I at MFA Design, we decided we needed to do podcasts because we wanted to expand our content. We have so many great speakers coming to speak to the students. We have so many great teachers, and I do this series of lectures for the students. So we thought we'd put content on our various websites, and we'd do them as video podcasts. We mm-hmm. recently just hired a videographer who has figured out a way of doing it so that it almost seems like professional television.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And so that's fun. And then when Core 77 asked me to do them, I jumped at the idea because I do interviews all the time. I mean, just as you do. I do interviews for print, and I do interviews for AIGA Voice. And this is a way of doing face-to-face interviews and working with a couple of my students who edit them. Right now, Randy Hunt is editing my Core 77 podcasts. And it's just an enjoyable thing to do that is not that difficult to learn. Mm-hmm. And if I had to learn something really special, like when I had to learn InDesign, I went crazy. Too many things to memorize. But this, you know, I can just press a button and ask questions and then upload it.
Now, let's talk a little bit before our next break about Art Basel. I read that you said that the fair was like an overwhelming experience, kind of like the boat show in New York City, minus the beckoning swimsuit sales girls. I'm sure that was a wonderful quote. Did you have a good time?
I did. I usually don't go out of the neighborhood.
Oh. On one of the radio shows that you did at the fair, the one with Stefan Sagmeister, you talked about art's recent poaching of design, which you indicated dates back to the pop artists and sort of symmetry in this interview with influences. And the notion of the total work of art that dates back to the Bauhaus, and you discussed where design fits in the scheme of personal versus public expression. And I wanted to know if you could elaborate a little bit more and talk about a little bit more of your opinion on that notion of total work of art and where design fits into the personal versus public expression.
Well, there are designers who are designing because this is their venue, this is their medium, and they're designing in very personal ways. Stefan Sagmeister is one of them. I just wrote an introduction for his forthcoming book. And what I loved about writing this introduction is that there are things that Stefan does that just transcend or bridge these heretofore prescribed media.
Mm-hmm.
And Stefan is an artist doing this work.
Oh, yeah, he's a conceptual artist, no question.
What I loved is he's doing a series of monkeys in Scotland, six monkeys, huge 30-foot monkeys. And I wrote endlessly about these monkeys, even though I've only seen sketches, but the whole idea is interesting to me. But the notion of being a designer and having a personal voice, anything that you produce that has more than just the client's imprimatur on it should have some sort of personality.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, design is about giving that personality. You know, it's not just following the templates. And while much design is about templating and stock art and things like that, there is this, within most of us, this desire to express. And I think if you have the right client, if you have the right venue, if you have the right sensibility, it's going to come out. And some of the best graphic design is stuff that comes out of that inspiration that you have, that personal motivation.
So do you feel that art's recent poaching of design is their sort of figuring out the conceptual aspect of what designers are doing finally? Or is it because they are getting lazy, or what do you think?
No, I think it's just
timing.
In the environment. Artists look around them, see what there is, and then incorporate it in themselves, and then translate it. You know, it's Rauschenberg and Lichtenstein, they were all commercial artists, so they
mm-hmm.
saw what...
Warhol.
They saw what was part of their job, and then they extrapolated and said, well, you know, this is also part of our culture, and how do we make it so that we're either commenting on it in a parodic way, or commenting on it in a serious way, or commenting on it by transforming it into something else.
So designers comment on it, and artists participate in it, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, we have to take a break. I know we have a caller on the line, which we'll come back to after the break. I'd like to let everybody know that they're listening to Design Matters with Debbie Millman on Voice America Business. I am your host, Debbie Millman, and my guest today is writer, editor, art director, and educator Stephen Heller. We will be right back with our broadcast after these messages, so please don't go away.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business. This is Voice America Business.
Welcome back to Voices of Design. We're speaking with Paul Sidlow of design agency Resonate. Paul, when you're creating a brand for a client, the worlds you can create can become quite complex. Tell us about that.
A specific example, there's a promo we recently did for The Triangle, which is a new sci-fi series. Typically, those spots are pure imagination and pure complexity. So in this case, it's the Triangle. It's this kind of fictionalized place where planes, boats, and people disappear. To create that kind of mysterious world, we created all the components as layers using After Effects. I'm talking about a layer app that is 150 layers deep, where everything, every component from lightning to waves to ships and 3D clouds and the rain are all rendered from the same scene as separate components.
You've been listening to Voices of Design, brought to you by Adobe. Coming up in the next break, Paul Sidlow talks about the future of design.
Dialogue is the single most powerful leadership tool we have to make a difference in the world. Leading Conversations with host Cheryl Esposito creates a place for that dialogue. Tune into the Voice America Business Channel every Friday as Cheryl hosts new conversations among leaders from around the world in business, government, art, economics, and social change. We'll explore big ideas and everyday actions and learn how their own leadership has led them to discover a newfound sense of possibility in the world. Leading Conversations with Cheryl Esposito, bringing big thinkers together in conversations that make a difference, right here on the Voice America Business Channel, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
We're back with Design Matters with Debbie Millman. If you have a question for Debbie, feel free to call us at 866-472-5790. Once again, here's the host of Design Matters, Debbie Millman.
Welcome back. It is 3:50 Eastern Time, and you are listening to Design Matters with Debbie Millman on Voice America Business. I am your host, Debbie Millman, and my guest today is writer, editor, art director, and educator Stephen Heller. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question for Steve, our phone lines will be open just a little bit longer. You can call 1-866-472-5790. And Steve, we do have a caller on the phone. She's been holding for a very long time to talk to you. We have Isabel. Isabel, thank you for calling Design Matters.
Hi, Debbie. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Steve, I actually have two questions, and they are not related at all, but I still want to know.
Sure.
With all that you do at the New York Times and independently, including the Daily Heller, how do you actually replenish yourself? I know how you mentally stimulate yourself, like with the crosswords and blogging and so on, but how do you just decompress and replenish? And my second question is, how do you enjoy working with your wife?
Well, I'll answer the first question first. Second question first. See, I don't replenish myself all that well. I love working with my wife. She's probably the most brilliant designer I know. And the reason we met was I sent her a fan letter without any ulterior motive whatsoever. No, it's true.
Okay.
It's true.
Sorry.
And I had been married before to non-designers, and we had very little to talk about. So it's great. And she's actually in Italy right now working on one of her own books. She's started doing things without me. But it's been great. As far as replenishing goes, you know, I go to sleep at 11 and I wake up at 4:30. I get a ton of rest.
Okay.
Is that, you said you had two questions, Isabel.
Well, I just asked my two questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize they were...
They were together.
I thought it was a two-parter. Sorry about that.
I don't get all that much replenishment. I mean, I can't vacation very well, and I've never been able to, and I'd like to at some point. I'd like to figure out a way, maybe Zen in the next couple of months or something.
Do you get annoyed when people ask you how you do it all?
Well, I don't get annoyed because it's like, it's the conversation starter,
mm-hmm.
or ender, as the case may be. But I don't have a great answer, except I do it because that's what my compulsion is. We all have compulsions, and we all do different things. And I tend to compensate for whatever deficiencies I have by doing more of everything than I should.
Oh, okay. Well, speaking of more than everything, more of everything than you should. After I sent out my morning email announcing the show, Chip Kidd wrote back and wanted me to ask you when your Lustig book is coming out, and I promised him I would ask you.
Well, it's supposed to be about a year and a half. We're working on it now. There's Elaine Lustig Cohen, who I'm working on it with, his wife, has amazing material, and she's been doing basically the research in so far as getting the visual matter together and getting the documents together, and it's been amazing what we've found. I mean, it's amazing what you can put into a life, really. I mean, you think of people who have lived 80 years, 90 years, and just the amount of material that comes into their life, both good, bad, and indifferent. And Lustig only lived till he was 45. But
oh,
there is so much to be had, and so much of real importance when you think of it in terms of design. I mean, he was the total work of art. He did interiors. He did architecture. He designed a helicopter. He did the titles for Mr. Magoo, as well as the book jackets that he's known for, as well as his typography. But his design life goes back to when he was a kid, and he would create typographic forms, and he studied very briefly with I'm having a brain freeze. The great architect who did the Guggenheim Museum.
Frank Gehry.
Frank Lloyd Wright.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a Frank. So it's quite amazing to do this. Tamar Cohen, Elaine's daughter, is designing the book, and it'll be a family affair, but also a wonderful affair. I mean, there are so many people that came into his life, and some of them quite revelatory for me.
Steve, we have another caller on the line. We'll do a quick call with Suzanne from New York. Suzanne, thank you for calling Design Matters.
Hi. I just have a pretty quick question, but it's something that I'm always curious to know. I want to know, what was it like working at the New York Times?
I love it. I mean, I've left in terms of my day-to-day activity. I will be going back one day a week. But it is, you know, all things considered, the most stimulating place to be. I mean, the people you work with, or I've worked with, are highly intelligent, highly motivated, but also very funny.
They appreciate the value of design as well?
They appreciate the value of design very much. I couldn't have worked there if not for that. The design director who hired me, who became the assistant managing editor, Louis Silverstein, was a pioneer. And my boss now, Tom Bodkin, is just an amazing design advocate. And you couldn't do the things that needed to be done if the Times was not open to those things. And it's just a wonderful company. I can't say enough about it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you for calling, Suzanne. So, Steve, in our last few moments together...
No.
I know. You have another book coming out, Iron Fists, Branding the Totalitarian State, which is a book about graphic design as a propaganda tool. Is that correct?
Well, it's not so much a propaganda tool, although that's part of it. It's about creating the personalities of these heinous regimes. So it's about design, sometimes in a very benign way, that support the ethos and the ethic of these regimes, and in some cases supporting criminal activity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
very
not
timely.
It's very timely, yes. I mean, people are always saying, am I really making a metaphor for the current administration? Well, I'm not going to go that far.
Mm-hmm.
But what
you can
I am,
make our own assumptions.
You can make your own assumptions. Right. But what I can say is that I'm finding out, and what I wanted to do with this book was find out why the design of these regimes looked the way they looked, and who did them, and what kind of strictures and constrictions there were, and what kind of freedoms there were to do this kind of material. And it varies from the Nazis to the Italian fascists to the People's Republic of China to the Soviets. There's a wide range of creative endeavor, both creativity for the purpose of branding the state and creativity within the boundaries of who was doing it.
Well, that book will be out when?
I think it's 2008, spring.
Oh, okay. Well, we've come to the end of today's broadcast, and not only do I want to thank you for being on the show again, Steve, but I also just want to thank you for what you do for our world, our industry, and our lives. It's extraordinary.
Well,
the amount
you.
Of work that you do is unbelievable.
And I want to thank you because these are always the most fun interviews
oh,
I ever
thank
had.
You. Thank you. I'd like to also give a very special thanks to our sponsor, Adobe, my executive producer, Brian Travis at Voice America, Lisa Grant, and Jen Simon at Sterling. Joining me next week on Design Matters is the newest partner at Pentagram, Luke Heyman. Thank you for listening, and please remember, we can talk about making a difference, we could make a difference, or we can do both. I am Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you next week.
Voice America Business would like to thank you for tuning in for Design Matters with Debbie Millman. Be sure to listen every Friday at 12 Pacific Standard Time for another exciting hour of Design Matters. Right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.